who didn't get into the more sparsely populated, deconcentrated buildings. Mixed-income buildings are not the answer to low-income housing, Stash would say rightly. But she thought it anachronistic to look to government-run public housing to make up the brunt of a city's overall portfolio of affordable options. The cavalry was not coming, she would explain. The only way to get public benefits funded today is by harnessing the market motives of private entities. This meant that, in addition to mixed-income buildings, vouchers would serve an ever-increasing number of families, and former high-rise residents would have to be relocated to rehabbed public housing complexes that were less monolithic in their original designs. There were also single-room occupancy hotels. One would be built next to the new shopping center on Division and Clybourne. And under Clinton, the federal government was producing hundreds of thousands of affordable units through low-income housing tax credits, which offered incentives to private developers to reserve a small percentage of apartments in their buildings for people with modest incomes above the public housing threshold. Stash had served as a deputy in the Clinton administration's General Services Administration before coming to City Hall. Asked on her federal employment form if there was anything in her past that could be an embarrassment to the president or the country, she wrote that she'd lived a counterculture life in San Francisco in the 1960s. She wasn't asked to elaborate. In thinking about the plan for transformation, she wrestled with the same concerns that went into the reform of the welfare system and that had always bedeviled public housing. Should the entitlement go only to the neediest, lowest-income families? For how long? And how to refresh it for other needy families, discouraging recipients from staying in the system for generations? She wasn't sure of the answers. What she felt unequivocal about, though, was the harm caused by concentrated poverty. "What's the antidote to that?" she said. "It's mixing people from different economic backgrounds." A pragmatist who believed that the perfect is the enemy of the good, she refused to let public housing families remain in the dangerous status quo of high-rises. The bad situation in public housing required that we end it. The financing of the public-private real estate deals under the plan for transformation involved a Rubik's Cube of moving parts. Tax credits, soft loans, city and state funds, developer fees, Hope 6 grants. Various public and private entities had to be satisfied, and countless rules abided or officially rewritten. A large chunk of the funding for the Cabrini Green redevelopment was expected to come from the sale of market-rate apartments. But the project also benefited from $280 million in tax increment financing, a tricky bit of temporal juggling in which city money is made available for improvements in the present based on the presumption of the future gains in real estate taxes. To pull off the colossal endeavor, Daley, Stash, and the rest of his team said they needed to be free of numerous federal strictures, and they asked for special dispensations on allowable construction costs, contracting guidelines, rent limits, admission requirements, and many other rules. HUD had a designation called Moving to Work for its highest performing agencies that allowed for greater flexibility. Chicago was still anything but high performing. Yet this was the classification the city now sought. Andrew Cuomo, the future New York governor, was then Clinton's Secretary of Housing, and thought submitting to Chicago's demands would set a terrible precedent. If he made these exceptions for Daley, then the mayors of Indianapolis or Cincinnati would be in the next month asking for similar deals. But Daley went over Cuomo's head to President Clinton. The CHA was named a moving to work agency, granting it dozens of waivers of federal provisions. "We are going to be fighting this tooth and nail," Carol Steele announced. The Coalition to Protect Public Housing called for a moratorium on any demolition until the city could demonstrate that the plan for transformation wasn't just scattering families into the unknown. Steele had taken part in the years of negotiations that had finally settled the lawsuit Cabrini-Green residents filed against the CHA back in 1996. Under a consent decree, signed in 2000, six of the red high-rises would be demolished, not eight. And the replacement housing would include three times as many public housing units as Daley's proposal had allotted. Tenants would also be able to form a non-profit subsidiary and take 50% ownership of a partnership with the developer of the site. They would share in fees and profits, the money going to aid both displaced and remaining Cabrini residents. Steele now pointed out what she saw as basic arithmetic errors in the plan for transformation. The city was guaranteeing families with a valid lease as of October 1, 1999, the right to return to rehabbed public housing, or a new mixed-income development. But Daley's plan would reduce the city's stock by a third. In recent years, the city had eliminated thousands of public housing units, and many more sat vacant. Yet, there were 56,000 families on the CHA waiting list, 24,000 waiting for a housing choice voucher, and 80,000 people who were homeless. And many more low-income renters in the city struggled to find affordable housing options. Where would these tens of thousands of families go? "The mayor says that no one is going to be displaced," a protester at a rally outside City Hall said. "We say the mayor is a liar." In a way, the CHA was hoping to replicate the success of a scatter-site housing initiative started as part of the Gautreaux case, the class-action housing desegregation lawsuit against the agency that was first filed in 1966. Rather than waiting on the CHA to build housing in racially diverse or revitalizing areas, a judge finally ruled on the case in 1976. Families from Chicago public housing would enter a lottery, and the winners would be moved with vouchers into private rentals in better-off neighborhoods. By the late 90s, 7,100 families had taken part in the program and been relocated to areas with less crime, improved schools, and better job prospects. Only a few hundred were moved a year, so receiving neighborhoods, often white and suburban, didn't feel inundated, and the relocated families could receive counseling and assistance with mobility and be checked on and studied over time. But now the city was hoping to find permanent and temporary homes in the private market for more than 20,000 additional low-income families. A study of the Chicago rental market that was demanded by the Coalition to Protect Public Housing showed that the city wasn't even close to being able to handle this flood in demand. Chicago had an overall residential vacancy rate of just 4.5%, among the tightest in the nation, with the availability largely concentrated in the poorer sections of the city. More than 40,000 families were already renting with Section 8 vouchers, but another 500,000 renters in Chicago qualified for the subsidy, and the city had an affordable housing deficit of 140,000 units. The numbers gave the federal officials funding the project pause. HUD cannot approve a plan in which the CHA will displace more families than the housing market can accommodate, the department wrote in a letter to the CHA. In January 2000, Daley went ahead with the big public rollout. He'd convinced the Central Advisory Council, the tenant leadership body representing all the city's public housing developments, to endorse the proposal, breaking with the tenants who were trying to stop it. "With or without us, they were going to submit it anyway," Francine Washington, the president of the group, said. "At least this way, we were able to include our comments." With the tenant group backing the plan, HUD signed off on it as well. Then the city's largest foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, threw its institutional support behind the mayor's redevelopment effort, funding dozens of grants and funneling some $65 million into the efforts. Stash had been hired by MacArthur to lead this charge. She set about recruiting the many partners across the city needed to pull off the endeavor. She funded the researchers to study its efficacy, and she enlisted businesses to employ CHA residents who would now need to meet more stringent work requirements. "We were able to have an impact on a huge swath of the city that had been negatively impacted, and on the lives of thousands of people," Stash said. "It was a once-in-a-generation opportunity." J.R. Fleming. One night in May, 3 years into the plan for transformation. J.R. Fleming was leaving the Cabrini Row houses where he'd just sold an electric scooter when he saw the flashing blue lights of a police car behind him. He was in the passenger seat, with Aisha driving one of the Vanduras and the children strapped into the back. J.R. didn't have the van registered or insured, but that didn't stop him from jumping out and yelling, "What did I do?" He wasn't surprised to be pulled over. A couple of months earlier, police officers had raided his sister's apartment in 1017 North Larrabee, where J.R. stashed his bootlegging equipment and his merchandise. Acting on a tip, officers found several computers, 7 VCRs, televisions, speakers, and video cameras. Equipment, they claimed, that was being used to duplicate the stacks of unlicensed music, movies, and video games that they also confiscated from the apartment. JR's lawyer argued that he was a legitimate music and video producer, and there was no proof he intended to sell any of the merchandise. When prosecutors asked for a warrant to search the hard drives of JR's computers, they were denied. The charges were dropped, though JR never saw any of his confiscated equipment again. A week later, he found dents kicked into the doors of one of his vans, and the side-view mirrors bent back. He was told the cops did it. What surprised J.R. about being pulled over that night was how the officer responded. He was a white cop, a mountain, 6'4", 240 pounds. Without a word, the officer reached back and smashed a fist the size of a tree burl into J.R.'s face. Then he hit J.R. a second and a third time, knocking him to the ground. Aisha charged out of the van, yelling that the cops should just arrest J.R. He wasn't resisting. Knowing he was going to be locked up, J.R. tried to hand the cash he had in his pocket to Aisha. That's when the cop crossed the line. He stiff-armed Aisha in the chest, pushing her away. This was Cabrini Green on a warm spring night. 100 people were hanging out in front of the buildings. They saw the cop shove Aisha, and at once there arose a collective, "Whoa! Was that a punch? Did he touch her titties?" JR's own thoughts cleared. He took a steadying breath. He knew so much in these situations depended on not panicking. Turning to face the officer's partner, who'd followed him out of the squad car, JR raised his hands. "He didn't have to do her like this," he said. Positioning himself with his back to the big cop, he drew a bead on the man's chin. This could have been avoided. On the last word, he slammed back his right elbow, connecting with the officer's jaw. A tooth arced through the air and landed silently on the ground. The cop followed, dropping like a felled oak. And with that, J.R. knelt down and crossed his hands above his head, trying to give the second officer no more excuse than he already had to shoot him dead. "That was murder, she wrote," J.R. said. "That changed the rest of my life." The arrest didn't come easily. Responding officers arrived, running toward J.R. armed with nightsticks. What was he to do? He defended himself. In the scuffle, he was hit with a steel flashlight. Officers blasted pepper spray into his face. He was wrestled into the back of a squad car and charged with 2 counts of aggravated battery of a police officer, 1 count of resisting arrest, and a single count of criminal damage to a government vehicle. As the arrest report stated, offender using his feet kicked out passenger side rear window. JR said he needed to break the cruiser's window. He couldn't breathe after all the pepper spraying. If found guilty of all 4 counts, JR could spend the next 16 years in prison. He'd be 46 when he got out, his children grown. J.R. had a fairly extensive rap sheet, with 11 misdemeanors for criminal trespassing, theft, disorderly conduct, failure to disperse, and the 1 previous felony for the drug sale he did up on the far north side when he was 18. But his lawyer argued self-defense, showing that the police had a track record of intimidating J.R. Brother Jim, writing the judge, attested to J.R.'s complicated relationship with police officers. Some like him and even purchase merchandise from him. Others have arrested him for a number of minor offenses. More than 40 Cabrini residents admitted to seeing the incident. But only three of them, who weren't family to J.R., agreed to testify, the others fearing retaliation from the police. Officers gave conflicting testimony about who approved the use of excessive force, and a commander's signature appeared on a permission form, even though he wasn't on the scene. J.R.'s lawyer requested a history of complaints and internal investigations into misconduct for each officer. The trial dragged on, with continuances and court dates stretching into months and then more than a year. J.R. believed it would help his cause if he could demonstrate his dedication to his community. He needed to show the judge that he wasn't some thug. The women running his old building allowed him to turn an empty apartment in 1017 North Larrabee into a recording studio. He brought guys together from the different sections of Cabrini Green, some of them in rival gangs, to cut a track for the Coalition to Protect Public Housing. "It's such a shame we living in vain. They took our neighborhood. They don't want us to change. This is where my mother grew up. This where my family grew up. Thank the Lord he sent us to save the Greens through us." He took part in the 100 Men Standing, a mentoring program for Cabrini Green Fathers. He started a chapter of the Hip Hop Congress, a social activism and arts nonprofit found mostly on college campuses. His was the only one in a public housing development, and he said it was a way to use music to reach the masses, to connect colleges with the community. One of his first events was a hip-hop holidays for the homeless. "Homelessness ends with hope," he announced. With less time for peddling, he used his heat press to design T-shirts for the Save Cabrini movement. J.R. started organizing as well for the Coalition to Protect Public Housing. He sat down in Carol Steele's office, where posters displayed words of inspiration. "Poverty is the worst form of violence. Gandhi." "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." Franklin Delano Roosevelt. "Trust God." In a lilting voice that belied her toughness, a bullishness not unlike J.R.'s, Steele explained all that had been going on with the plan for transformation. Few city agencies could have handled a task of such immensity, of such political and human nuance, but the CHA had a long track record of being among the least efficient and worst managed of government departments. For patronage hires, it was a backwater, the better skilled of the well-connected usually opting to earn a paycheck elsewhere. When the plan for transformation got underway, moreover, the CHA was just coming out of its federal takeover, its workforce being shrunk from 2,500 employees to a mere 500. Even for the remaining employees who were diligent, thoughtful, and caring, they were unprepared for the political pressures of the transformation process. The word from City Hall was to empty the high-rises, and observers reported a wartime atmosphere at the CHA. "We just really give up on the ones who have a lot of problems," said a contractor hired by the CHA to assist residents with their relocations. "By that time, we just can't do nothing for them. I mean, we can't even find them. So how can we serve them?" The CHA was surprised to learn how many people in its buildings had mental or physical disabilities, suffered from trauma, or abused alcohol or drugs. These families needed the help of a social worker, not a relocation counselor. "Once we started digging, we had no idea how bad it was from the perspective of people needing services," said Lewis Jordan, one of several heads of the CHA who would be in charge of the transformation. Of the tens of thousands still living in public housing, many had spent decades there. And without the proper guidance, a great number of them didn't see announcements, missed meetings downtown, and, on hearing about the multiple steps involved in their moves, gave up. Those who did follow each task met with relocation managers and attended workshops on good neighboring and money management. They filled out the numerous forms stating whether they preferred a permanent or temporary move, whether they were willing to rent in the private market with a voucher, or wished to stay in a rehabbed public housing development. If they were behind on rent or had unpaid utility bills, or if they had a relative on their lease with a criminal record or didn't meet new employment requirements, they raced to become lease compliant. Then they joined trips to scout homes in other neighborhoods. But the relocation counselors each handled more than 100 cases at a time. They were supposed to show every family 5 possible residences. But that didn't happen. The counselors were paid per case closed, and in many instances had established relationships with specific landlords. Overseeing a vast network of thousands of Section 8 landlords presented its own challenges. Many landlords in the private market offered homes far superior to public housing. But there were also many who were inexperienced as far as tying their low-income renters to social services. Some illegally turned families away or refused to repair leaks or faulty furnaces. Apartments weren't up to code. Negligent landlords were rarely punished. And when they were, tenants suffered, since they were forced to relocate again, uprooting their families, starting the search process all over, and dealing once more with utilities, the phone company, and a rental deposit. By the end of 2002, the city had demolished 6,900 units of public housing. But it had yet to rehab any public housing units that weren't reserved for seniors, and it had built only 130 units of public housing in mixed-income buildings since 2000. Many residents, failing to find apartments before their move-out dates, doubled up with family members elsewhere, or left their condemned public housing and moved into other public housing in the city not yet scheduled for demolition. Residents too often left one unsafe or unsanitary apartment for another, and then another. Not infrequently, families were sent across gang boundaries. The plan for transformation was probably the most disgusting thing I ever saw as an organizer. How little care was taken for the people who were being displaced, said Jim Field, who worked first with the Community Renewal Society and then the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. The general public actually cares about homeless people. That is not the case with how they feel about public housing residents. The stories coming out of public housing of shootings and killings, most mainline people say, well, we're paying for that. But they can frequently identify with homelessness. Facing criticism, the CHA agreed to let an independent monitor assess its progress. Thomas Sullivan, a former U.S. attorney, confirmed that the buildings were closed in an unnecessary rush, that tenants lacked proper counseling and were thrown into a state of mass confusion. Nearly every relocated family, he found, ended up in neighborhoods that were primarily African American, and 3/4 in areas that were overwhelmingly poor. These were not the sole rebuilding opportunities that the transformation promised. And now families were in strange territory and without their former support networks. The result has been that the vertical ghettos from which the families are being moved are being replaced with horizontal ghettos, located in well-defined, highly segregated neighborhoods on the west and south sides of Chicago, Sullivan wrote. The plan for transformation didn't so much break up concentrations of poverty as move them elsewhere, making them less visible to the rest of the city. A class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of the relocated residents, asserting that the city had been resegregated. The CHA followed many of Sullivan's 54 recommendations. It hired a new social service provider, vastly improving how the agency relocated families. But problems with relocations also persisted. Tenants had signed a right to return agreement stipulating that anyone with a lease at the start of October 1999 had a shot at coming back to whatever replaced the old high-rise housing projects. Now, 9 in 10 families said they wanted to return to their longtime neighborhoods, twice as many as the CHA had predicted. At Cabrini Green, the CHA signed a right-of-return contract with 1,770 families. Those who wanted to come back had to take temporary vouchers and move elsewhere. Some didn't meet the new rules for returnees regarding work requirements. Others were evicted with one-strike drug laws or for other reasons. As more time went by, some died, others were simply lost. The process was much worse at other large developments that were torn down hastily. A few years into the transformation effort, the CHA placed ads in local newspapers stating that it actually couldn't account for some of the 16,800 families it had ostensibly been tracking. And would anyone from the following list of 3,200 families please contact them in the next 90 days or risk losing the right to return to public housing? It was perfect timing, JR would say. He was fighting his own legal case as the plan for transformation was rolling out. Getting involved was an easy choice. I decided I wanted to play a role. I saw the suffering wouldn't stop. At the same time that the city was carrying out its plan for transformation, the Housing Authority considered selling 1230 North Burling to its tenants. The building had long been celebrated as the exception to everything believed to be wrong with Cabrini Green. During the federal takeover of the CHA, HUD determined that the tenant managers of 1230 North Burling had improved living conditions and reduced neglect and abuse, allowing for resident empowerment and economic uplift. Now the residents proposed buying their home. Their offer was far below the market value of the property, and they asked also that the federal government continue to subsidize maintenance costs at the high-rise for a decade after the sale. Residents pointed out that developers were being given sweeter incentives to build around Cabrini Green, and that the government paid Section 8 landlords to house low-income renters. By operating 1230 North Burling as a nonprofit co-op, they would be able to provide homes to 134 public housing families. They'd earn sweat equity in the property as well, their work compensating for what they couldn't afford in a down payment. The sale was endorsed by local politicians and civic leaders and approved, albeit unenthusiastically, by the CHA. Many deemed the proposal a poor use of public resources, with a high likelihood of failure. The Illinois Housing Development Authority and Chicago's Department of Housing and Economic Development ultimately killed the deal. Still, the CHA continued to see the Burling Building as an ally in its plans for Cabrini Green. In 2002, Carol Steele ran to unseat Cora Moore as the head of the Tenant Council for all of Cabrini. When the polls closed, Moore led 260-66. But 4 hours later, an additional 222 ballots from the row houses were discovered, and then subsequently lost, with Steele winning 201 of them. After other ballots were disqualified, Steele was declared the winner, with an overall edge of 261-214. The CHA didn't want to concede the election to Steele. In addition to the questionable ballots, Steele had been involved in the lawsuit that halted work on the Cabrini Extension high-rises and was a leader in the Coalition to Protect Public Housing. The agency called for a new round of voting. There'd been other irregularities as well. Poll watchers were unable to enter buildings where votes were cast. Electioneering occurred at polling sites. In one high-rise, voters each received two ballots. And in 1230 North Burling, Moore's stronghold, the ballots weren't properly initialed. The election ended up in court, with the CHA providing Moore an attorney. In their arguments, the lawyer cited both Shakespeare and the recent precedent of Bush versus Gore, which differentiated between the counting of spoiled and missing ballots. The CHA lawyers attacked Steele's character, saying she hired her boyfriend to manage the row houses. The back and forth lasted 8 months, until a judge decided that the transgression of the missing ballots was less egregious than the failure of initialing them, at least as far as Illinois election law went. Steele was declared the winner. Other buildings at Cabrini Green also formed their own self-management corporations. The CHA accused the resident management group that Steele led in the row houses of permitting squatters to stay in empty units and of spending some $300,000 on salaries and fees, in excess of what federal law allowed. Then, in 2003, at 6 a.m., The CHA raided 1230 North Burling. Before padlocking the door of the resident management office, CHA officials emptied everything out, tossing computers and files into dumpsters. Dolores Wilson's daughter, Cheryl, found hundreds of dollars worth of tenants' uncashed rent checks scattered by the wind. In a press conference, the new head of the CHA, Terry Peterson, said he was firing the resident managers. He displayed photographs that had been taken during an earlier inspection of the building. They showed garbage in piles and a shopping cart lying on its side in a hallway. "Our residents deserve to live in safe, clean, and well-managed buildings," Peterson said. "Those are the kinds of conditions that are unacceptable, and that we're going to hold our property managers responsible for cleaning up." The tenants of 1230 North Burling, assured for years of a special status, struggled with their comedown. "They didn't give us a reason. They didn't tell us who they were," Cannon said. "They just said, 'Your services are no longer needed.'" He'd been in charge of maintenance of the building for more than a decade. Like the other resident managers, he lost his job. The building wasn't perfect. Nearly a decade after its renovation, the front doors were dented and the plexiglass in the entranceway fogged. On the landings and ramps, years of winter ice and salt had stripped the concrete floors, and the brick walls in the hallways, painted a Stygian red, were scribbled with graffiti. But it wasn't what the CHA was claiming. The conditions before the residents took over were truly unacceptable. "Our suspicion is obviously that they want to take over the building, deplete the number of people in it, and then say it's uninhabitable, and then move people out so they can demolish it," the head of the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, Ed Cherna, said. "I felt it was the end," Dolores Wilson said. "If they could just come in and close down a corporation, they could do anything." She expected to hear from the politicians and officials who had worked with her and her neighbors over the years, who had trained them and funded their efforts. "I was thinking Bertha Gilkey would have come to cheer us up or tell us how to follow through. I thought she would have at least called," Dolores said. "She knew we were doing a good job. No one ever gave an explanation. You would think they would tell us why they did that to us." J.R. Fleming. J.R. discovered that activism was a lot like peddling. He made the same rotations on the land at Cabrini Green, visiting all the remaining high-rises and row houses. His customers still listened to his playful patter when he was selling tales of injustice and broken promises. He told residents that the city's plan for devastation could be deemed a success only if the metric were getting poor people off prime real estate and moving them to areas where there were even fewer jobs and transportation options, where crime, gangs, and schools were all worse. He liked the sport in being a gadfly, a pest to those in power. With the other members of the Coalition to Protect Public Housing, he'd go to CHA board meetings, using the public comment portion to call out officials as chump change opportunists and sell out daily lackeys. His voice booming, he repeated how Cabrini residents had been displaced, how their rights of return were being hindered, how resident-owned businesses didn't receive contracts and tenants weren't hired for construction jobs. The CHA launched a new brand reinvention, executed for free by the Chicago ad agency Leo Burnett, turning the letters of the housing authority into the word change. The image, "This is change," appeared all over the city, alongside pictures of residents and their testimonials of better lives. In 2005, artist activists covered up the ads on bus stops with similar-looking displays that reworked the agency's logo to "This is chaos." The alternative campaign featured large photos of either Mayor Daley, Terry Peterson, or other housing officials alongside accusatory questions. Are tourists more important than the poor? Do money and politics mix? The one featuring the prominent Chicago real estate developer Dan McLean read, "When the mayor's plan for transformation called for the demolition of Cabrini Green, McLean got the scoop early and began buying up adjacent properties. McLean cashes in on our tax dollars with no risk. J.R. defined the CHA's new slogan as, "Chicago helps all Negroes go elsewhere." He advised tenants who were facing removal or bouncing around among Section 8 rentals. It was exciting to lead 100 residents in chants as they marched downtown. "Aren't y'all tired of running?" he demanded of his neighbors. "We're from the Greens. We can't let them take our history." Back in 1998, for the 50th anniversary of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Carol Steele and other CHA residents had traveled to New York to give testimony about their fight back home. Cabrini Green was so vilified, so closely associated with crime and drugs, that it was hard for residents to find allies in their hometown. But in New York, activists from around the world made it clear that they considered the battle on the near North Side to be part of their larger global struggle. For J.R., the formulation of housing as a human right provided him a game plan that he could run with. He started carrying a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in his back pocket, whipping it out and brandishing it like a weapon. In the same way he used to spout copyright laws when hawking bootleg gear, he now recited the UN document, Article 25-1. "Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care and necessary social services." He began to attend human rights conferences and events across the country, with organizations paying his way. Every couple of weeks, J.R. went before the judge overseeing his assault case and asked her for permission to leave Illinois, to attend conventions in Atlanta, Philadelphia, New York, Virginia, New Jersey, Maryland. In a letter Steele sent to the judge, she praised J.R.'s work, writing, "He encourages young men and women to participate in the processes that will determine the fate of their community, as the Chicago Housing Authority's plan for transformation changes the nature and makeup of the Cabrini Green community." The judge was both impressed and confused. She looked at J.R.'s past arrests, the crime he'd committed, his lack of even a GED, and she tried to square that with the letters inviting him to speak at the United Nations World Urban Forum. She permitted all the trips, even one to Caracas, Venezuela, where J.R., sporting a Che Guevara bandana under a White Sox cap, met with Hugo Chavez's government about supplying oil to poor Chicagoans. The judge also let J.R. go to Las Vegas, where he and Aisha got married, a last-ditch effort to save their relationship. J.R. led a busload of Cabrini residents down to New Orleans as well, to assist with relief after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. He returned repeatedly over the next 3 years, observing each time how the city was restored everywhere but in its poor black neighborhoods. In New Orleans' lower Ninth Ward, the wrecked homes with spray-painted X's sat unchanged. Cars remained where they'd been washed under porches or flipped on their sides. "It was so obvious in New Orleans," J.R. would say. "Once the water went down, you could see exactly where the rebuilding occurred and where it didn't. The demographics of the whole city changed. That tools of displacement shit is real." Shortly after the flood, the New Orleans City Council voted to demolish much of the city's remaining public housing. 6 of its largest complexes were shuttered. The city lost more than 3,000 previously occupied units of public housing. "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans," a U.S. congressman from Louisiana boasted. "We couldn't do it, but God did." For J.R., New Orleans clarified what was going on in Chicago. Chicago didn't need a flood. He and his neighbors were being pushed out of the city center, out of Daley's global city. He was going to push back. Despite the objections of the dozens of police officers who attended the hearings, the judge in J.R.'s case ruled that he would be sentenced to no jail time. She gave him community service and 2 years probation, and ordered him to attend anger management classes. I've got anger issues with the system, J.R. would tell the psychologist. He grew his hair out and twisted it into ring-letted dreadlocks. It was around then that he legally changed his name from Willie McIntosh Jr. The new name was part of his new identity. I'm Willie J.R. Fleming, human rights enforcer, he'd say by way of introduction. The J is for just. The R is for righteousness. James Martin, the plainclothes cop at Cabrini Green nicknamed Eddie Murphy, had known J.R. and his family for decades. Reflecting on J.R.'s personal transformation, he joked that his colleagues on the police force had messed up. They should have left the young man alone when he was just peddling DVDs and tube socks. Now they went and woke him up. 15. Old Town, New Town. Kelvin Cannon. When he was young, Kelvin Cannon believed the towers of Cabrini Green were as immutable as mountains. They were as much a part of the natural landscape as the boundless plains of Lake Michigan. But I got older, he said, and I got wiser. He watched as the Ogden Avenue Bridge, his childhood playground, disappeared, the barricaded overpass eventually torn down. He learned for himself the history of Cabrini Green, that the neighborhood had previously been Irish, Swedish, and Italian, that the Cabrini row houses and high-rises were built on top of an existing ghetto that had once seemed permanent until it wasn't. Cannon came to subscribe to a pragmatism born of fatalism. Change was something the powerful imposed on everyone else. In 2003, Mayor Daley had ended debate over the future of a downtown airport by sending in bulldozers late at night and tearing up the runways. He had Lakeshore Drive moved to create a downtown museum campus. Imagine what he'd do to public housing. Cabrini was an eyesore for the Gold Coast, Cannon said. The plan to transform us was mandated in the early 70s. It was only a matter of time. Inevitable. The community might be able to save the row houses, he believed. The high rises? No chance. I was taught it's best to sit at the table with people so we can coexist, he explained. All we can do now is negotiate and try to get as much as we can coming back as public housing units. Cannon respected Carol Steele. He didn't deny that the lawsuits and all the protests had served a purpose. But Cannon figured that Miss Steele had lost her way. A decade had passed since the millions in federal Hope Six dollars were first earmarked for the rebuilding of Cabrini, and in all that time, little had been done. For the last three of those years, Steele was president of the Cabrini Tenant Council. She tangled with the city and with Peter Holston, the developer who won the contract to rebuild parts of Cabrini Green. 3 years wasted, Cannon said. In the process of tearing down, we were supposed to be rebuilding the mixed income. But Miss Steele couldn't come to an agreement with Holston. Nothing was built. A lot of residents were being displaced, and a lot of those people were never found again. In 2004, Cannon decided he'd try to unseat Steele as Tenant Council president. He considered himself more than qualified. At 41, he'd lived at Cabrini Green for all but the 3.5 years that he'd been incarcerated. And it had been nearly a quarter century since his sole conviction for armed robbery, and 15 since he'd left the Gangster Disciples. He'd apprenticed under Cora Moore when she was tenant president. He worked alongside her and Dolores Wilson to self-manage their high-rise. He'd done maintenance and construction. Steele's vice president reported Cannon to a gang crime commission, saying that a gangster disciple was trying to take over the multi-million dollar rehab of Cabrini Green. But Cannon let it be known that he'd turned himself over to God. Given a second chance, he dedicated himself to the community. In some conservative circles, in fact, Cannon was hailed as an exemplar of the redemptive capabilities of self-reliance. He was invited to join members of the Empowerment Network, a pro-faith policy group that included Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum and other socially conservative members of Congress. As a former gang member, Cannon was presented as living proof that even the intractable problems of the inner city could be overcome through the resilient power of freedom and free markets, and the reliance of its citizens on our deep wellspring of faith in God. The Empowerment Network's director, David Caprera, had specialized in resident-directed initiatives at HUD under Jack Kemp. "God bless your achievements, your family, and 1230 North Burling," he wrote to Cannon. "You are our hero." Cannon wasn't about to run away from his gang past either. He wagered that people at Cabrini Green would recall that he'd commanded the disciples without abusing his authority. Being a GD governor, he felt, proved that he was someone who stuck with whatever he started and rose to positions of leadership. He put on a shirt and tie and a V-necked sweater, donned his leather coat, and started to walk the land of Cabrini Green, going door to door to every apartment, telling people why he should be president. He collected signatures and asked residents for their vote. Cannon liked to canvass alone. He felt people would recognize his fearlessness and determination. He made the rounds of the whites, the reds, and the row houses. When he completed the circuit, he started again. Half of the units were now vacant, but nobody really knew which ones were empty or occupied, who was on a lease and who could vote and who wasn't. For 3 months, he tried to reach everyone. Cannon spoke in intermittent bursts, his words suddenly rushing out in a torrent as he tried to explain that the election was a referendum on redevelopment. Under Carol Steele, they were missing their only chance to be a part of the evolving area. They had to embrace the change. They had to trust that too many lawyers were already involved in the plan for transformation for it to go wrong. Carol Steele and her backers called Cannon a crony of the CHA and the developers. They pointed out that when Holston opened Northtown Village, a private mixed-income development across from 1230 North Burling, he'd given Cannon a job there as a security guard. Steele said Cannon was at best naive. Hadn't a decade of broken promises proven that the CHA couldn't be trusted? How many times had residents been told that they were part of the planning process, only to be pushed aside when the city decided to go ahead with its own agenda? Steele wasn't holding up the process, she said time and again. She was trying to make sure that what occurred was legal and in compliance with its stated aims. We said, "Show us the land. Show us the money and show us the housing." But the CHA couldn't produce. That's why it's been a long, drawn-out process. She wanted proof that those with a right of return could truly return to Cabrini Green, that they would actually be mixed into the new housing. Earlier in 2004, Cabrini residents filed another lawsuit against the CHA, after 400 families were issued eviction notices that would have pushed them out long before the building of any replacement housing. Experience had taught her that the CHA fulfilled its promises to tenants only when a judge ordered it to do so. On the day of the vote, Cannon passed out walkie-talkies to his friends and family to coordinate as they ushered residents to the polling places and watched for improprieties. Turnout, as at most public housing elections, was light. Also, many who did vote spoiled their ballots. They liked both candidates, so they picked each of them. In the final count, Cannon received a couple dozen more votes. Steele challenged the results, but the CHA approved the tally. She said she lost because the CHA and the city wanted her out. Cannon wasn't so much elected as selected. Cannon credited his victory to a higher power than the Chicago Housing Authority and even Mayor Daley. He said he had God on his side. One of Cannon's first acts as president was to move the tenant council offices north of Division, into 1230 North Burling. He combined two units on the first floor of his high-rise to create a space big enough. Then, weeks later, he signed the agreement to finally start work on the new housing that would replace the Cabrini Extension Towers. He put his faith in Peter Holston, who'd been awarded the contract to develop the mixed-income complex. "We are blessed to have him as a partner," Cannon said. Holston had grown up in the western suburbs, and after an MBA at the University of Chicago took him to the South Side, he stumbled into real estate and won business with the city. Public housing, he related, came to encompass my life work. He said he learned quickly that it wasn't enough to hand public housing families the keys to an apartment and say, live happily ever after. He believed in a model of in-your-face management, strict but respectful. I'm sorry, Mrs. Jones, you're being put out because your son set fire to the apartment. Maybe we can get your son in a program somewhere, and I can convince management to keep you here. That's the yin and the yang, Holston would explain. Obey the rules or else. He hired case managers to help tenants search for jobs and stay current on their bills. He kept a social service consultant on site in each of his properties. I want all the kids in my buildings to go to college. I want the heads of households to be employed and for the cycle of poverty to be broken, Halston said. I know that's not going to happen. What do I settle for short of that? I try to give them the best house that I can. I try to get everyone to be neighborly. Over the previous decade, a dozen market-rate developments with public housing units mixed in had opened on the periphery of Cabrini Green. Private developers competed for the building rights as well as the tax credits and favorable financing. For centrally located Cabrini Green, it didn't take much to lure investors. Residential property sales in the two-block radius around Cabrini Green totaled less than $6 million in 1995. But 5 years later, at the start of the plan for transformation, annual sales had reached $120 million. And from 2000 to 2005, total sales neared $1 billion. In 1999, when Holston won the rights to develop Northtown Village, he priced the for-sale units to sell at a discount of 15% below the area's going rate. 79 of the 261 condos and townhomes were reserved for public housing families, and he thought buyers might balk at the unique arrangement. Part of the pitch made to young professionals was that they would be social pioneers, embarking on a new form of urban living. People of different races and classes were going to live alongside one another, under the same roof. But being a pioneer also meant acting boldly and getting in ahead of others. It meant staking a claim before prices rose and the land was fully settled. Months ahead of construction on Northtown Village, when a sales trailer first opened at the site, the units went fast. 47 that day, 80 by the end of the week. Cabrini Towers still defined the landscape. But buyers trusted that the high-rises would soon give way to even higher property values, and Northtown Village was pronounced one of the city's hottest real estate markets. Just a stone's throw from the Gold Coast, River North, Old Town, and Lincoln Park, Cabrini Green is easily one of the most sought-after neighborhoods in all of Chicago, gushed a write-up from a local real estate firm. Northtown Village townhomes sold for as much as $475,000. A young couple who bought a condo described a buying frenzy, one woman yelling at her husband, "Just buy whatever's left!" The area that had been Cabrini Green, and before that, Little Sicily and Little Hell, some realtors now try to rebrand as Newtown, dropping the Cabrini Green moniker inimical to their interests. Peter Holston named the mixed-income complex that replaced several red Cabrini high-rises along Division Street Parkside of Old Town. Among the dignitaries at the groundbreaking for the complex, Holston was joined by the CHA's Terry Peterson, Alderman Walter Burnett, and Kelvin Cannon, his shovel raised, wearing a do-rag beneath his hard hat and a white cashmere topcoat despite the mud. Daly announced that Cabrini Green was now part of the larger Old Town neighborhood. Latasha Ricks, one of Annie Ricks's daughters, helped build Parkside's combination of mid-rises and townhomes. Even though I was president and a partner in the development, Cannon said, I helped build it too. I was out there in the fields. I was there as a laborer. During the construction, Holston pre-sold 70% of Parkside's market-rate units, purchasers putting down 5% of the price. That was in 2006, 2 years before anyone could move in, and buyers paid $500,000 to nearly $750,000 for the townhomes, with the condos starting at $300,000. many people snapped up two units, figuring they'd flip one later as prices continued to climb. Holston planned initially to complete one mid-rise before starting on the others. But with the money from pre-sales and the increasing demand, he began construction on the entire 760-unit complex, all 228 townhomes, and several mid-rises. One of the new owners in 2006 was Abu Ansari, whose partner, Mark, surprised him with the floor plans to their unbuilt Parkside condo. A stage actor from Texas, Ansari had moved to Chicago in the early 90s, and he'd followed news of the plan for transformation, wondering whether public housing residents would be forced to leave at the very moment that their neighborhoods started to flourish. His own mother had grown up in public housing in San Antonio, and as a black gay man in a relationship with an older white man, he was attuned to the stark divisions of race and class in his new city. How many times had he used the word gentrifier as a slur? And now he might be one of them, in of all places Cabrini-Green. But 2 years is a long time to get over your misgivings. Prices around Cabrini rose higher still, and Abu and Mark talked about their prescience for getting in early. And when their Parkside mid-rise actually went up, the design exceeded their expectations. The building was the opposite of the towers it replaced. Squat and broad, it was a multi-sided prism, reigning genially over the corner of Division Street and Seward Park, like a cross-legged Buddha. Its orange-bricked facade was adorned with splashes of purple ornamentation and decorative pillars. Every unit had a balcony. Abu and Mark started to embrace the idea of themselves as pioneers in an exciting social experiment. When Abu and Mark finally moved in, it was bliss. Their ninth-floor apartment was roomy and modern, facing out over the new supermarket complex and Lincoln Park beyond. They hosted dinner parties.